syndicated columnist and your host. And stay tuned for a very interesting half hour with my guest, anthropologist and father, Dr. Kermit Anderson, who will talk to us about the dad effect, what his research and other science tells us about how being a father transforms both men and children. So one of the things I really loved growing up was going with my dad to his office on Saturday morning, which my sisters and I sometimes did when we were little. My dad is now retired, but he was a real estate broker and sold small commercial buildings in Detroit. Now, predictably, his office was not a fun place. In fact, it was kind of boring. We'd just sit there and color or read for a few hours, and then the special thing, he'd take us to McDonald's or this restaurant that was probably only in Michigan called Red Barn. It just felt so special to be there with my dad, to be lunching with my dad, and I think about this when I go to a cafe where I write on Saturday and see a dad come in with his son or daughter and have breakfast. Always reminds me of my dad and those Saturdays we spent with him. And it's one of those things that made me want to do this show about what it means to be a dad and how dads and kids do and can benefit each other. So my guest, anthropologist Dr. Kermit Anderson, does a lot of studies on fatherhood and has co-authored a book on the subject with fellow anthropologist Peter B. Gray, and it's Fatherhood, Evolution and Human Paternal Behavior. You should also check out Anderson and Gray's blog at Psychology Today. It's called The Evolving Father. So stick with us tonight as he separates the myths from the science on what dads mean for their children's lives and vice versa. Hello, Kermit.
Yes, hello, Amy.
So you explain in your book that humans are the most paternal primate. Tell us how we differ in that from our hairier relations.
Well, to put it, first of all, in perspective, you think about mammals in general, because of internal gestation and pregnancy and live birth, most mammal males do nothing, you know, beyond copulation, insemination, that's it. 95% of mammals, males do absolutely nothing. In primates, it's a lot higher. About 40% of primates, males are involved with babies after they're born. But humans are pretty much beyond that, you know, because every human society, males are expected to be involved to some extent with their offspring. It varies a lot in the details cross-culturally about exactly what they do and how involved they are, but that is an expectation, and it goes on for years. Every other primate, even if the male's involved, when the baby's weaned and the new the next baby comes along, usually basically babies are weaned from the mom, you know, when she's pregnant with the next baby, the baby has to, the now juvenile has to fend for himself, really, or herself, feed himself at least. It's not an adult yet. It still depends on his parents for some social skill learning and so forth, but it has to feed itself. Humans are obviously very different. You know, even in hunter-gatherers, human kids don't really start to produce more food than they eat until they're in their late teens, essentially 18. So there's this virtually two-decade commitment, but we don't space babies out 2 decades apart, do we? You know, even hunter-gatherers, they space babies out 4 or 5 years apart. So a couple may have 3, 4 dependent kids at once that they have to provide for. And human females can't do that by themselves. They need others. And it can be relatives, but in essentially every society, it's also dads.
Yeah, it's and your book, that's the subject of your book, and it has a good sex story livening it up. Jane Goodall telling you of a chimpanzee female who had mated 50 times in a single day with 7 different males. On the bright side, there's no walk of shame if you can't walk at the end of the day. But let's talk about the greater parental investment in humans and what you think led to it.
Well, we definitely get into the area of speculation to some extent, but we know you go back 1.8 million years when Homo erectus first appeared, called Homo ergaster in Africa. This is one of the, you know, extinct hominin species that essentially from the neck down looks a lot like us. It had a smaller brain than we do. Its bones are a little heavier, but it stood about 6 feet tall and basically had a modern pelvis, the same as ours. So women were giving birth and walking upright. They were fully bipeds. You know, we've been bipeds for a couple million years by this point. The brains only continued to get bigger. And again, people were giving birth to fairly dependent offspring who would need a lot of help and support, more than a female could probably provide for her own offspring, especially if she had to care for several at once. And so males had to get involved. Now, it could have been, you know, some speculation, it could have been brothers, right? Brothers could have gotten involved and helped their sisters, potentially, because you know you're related to your sister's kids. But at some point, it's a little speculative, but if the mating behaviors changed from a chimpanzee kind of pattern where, yes, females had sex with every single male in the band and males were having sex with all the females and no one knew who the father was, if it shifted at some point to where males, because of sexual behavior, were more confident that they were the fathers of these children, and they started investing in the children, that was a huge radical shift, and you basically had the birth of the family, what we recognize as the nuclear family, of males being involved with their mates' offspring, because those offspring are likely to be theirs.
And now you have this very interesting theory that this has to do with male mate guarding.
That's definitely one of the theories out there. You know, it has something to the idea, and this goes back a couple of decades, and there's some debate about this. I mean, some primate species are very prominent for having sexual swellings, you know, and a strong estrus period. So there's a very brief period where females have sex, and like chimpanzees, they may have a lot of sex, and they have big, bright sexual swellings that everyone can see and everyone knows about. Humans lack that. So there's a big debate with human sexual behavior, you know. Is ovulation concealed? Does anyone know when females are ovulating? If you don't know, the logic was, if you don't know when the female is ovulating, the male basically has to hang around throughout her cycle, and once that starts happening, then he keeps other males away, and he's basically going to be father of her child. So that's one of the things. It turns out it's a little bit simplistic in that a lot of primates don't have sexual swellings. A lot of other primates, including bonobos, don't have quite the strict estrus behavior we once thought they did. Bonobos have sex throughout most of their cycle, you know. So and they don't do the kind of pair bonding that we do. So it's a little simplistic that it's simply due to mate guarding, but that certainly seems to be part of the equation that males do, you know, if they hang on a female more often and are confident that they're the father of her offspring, then they will invest in those kids.
So, well, we should, I guess, define what parental care is. You talk about parental care being both active and passive, direct and indirect. So tell us what parental care is and then what you mean by these definitions.
Well, there's another, depends on who you ask. It's a bit like art. People know what it is when they see it. you can define parental investment, and sometimes argue parental investment is something that has a cost. So if I have some food and I give it to my offspring, that's food I can't eat, right? So there's a different cost to that. If I spend time playing with my offspring, then I could have spent that time hunting or gathering or doing or chasing after females, then there's a cost to that. So that can be very costly. Now, if it's a little more passive, for example, if I defend my territory and I'm keeping other males out who might be infanticidal, who might also try to steal my mate or copulate with my mate, that protects my offspring, but it protects my interest. And it also just keeps predators out as well, you know. So there are ways of protecting my offspring that don't involve the cost the same way. You can have multiple benefits. I mean, a modern example might be if I sit on the couch watching TV and I'm watching TV with my kids, you know, is that quality time? You know, I'm spending time with my kids. That's a little different than reading a book to my child or, you know, talking, having a conversation one-on-one with my child. But it's still clearly time with your kids.
Yeah, and now in modern society, there's some very important behaviors we've lost. And one example you give is fathers sleeping next to their kids. Now, it's only in very, very recent history that children or anyone have had their own room. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, the whole co-sleeping debate is potentially a can of worms if you Google that or look online or ask healthcare professionals or you know about co-sleeping.
Oh, no, I've written about this with McKenna.
Yes.
I know about co-sleeping and having a sidecar, which makes it safer rather than so you won't roll over in your child.
That is virtually a North American debate. This really doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. You know, like as you pointed out, kids have only had their own rooms very, very recently. You look at any society until very recently, everyone slept in the same room together, parents and kids, or before you had buildings, you slept around the same campfire. It was very social. You never spent any time by yourself. You weren't ever sent off by yourself to your room or to be someplace by yourself because that just would have been dangerous. You know, if you're in the jungle or something, you send your kid off, you know, to be by themselves. They're defenseless. You know, that's essentially a way of, you know, getting rid of your kid. So, but even in medieval times or, you know, up and through the Industrial Revolution, you can read people's diaries and people, you know, slept in the same room together and they went to bed when it got dark and they might wake up in the middle of the night briefly and then go back to sleep. And you just didn't have that kind of privacy.
Yeah, it's so, so interesting how we've changed. And so do you recommend, do you recommend that parents sleep with their child?
Oh, boy, that's... you're the advice goddess. I don't so much get into
right.
that kind of advice for several reasons. I remember a little bit of a personal anecdote when my wife and I were expecting our first child, and we went to a couple of baby prepping classes, which I remember there was a woman there who acted as if you, basically her attitude, if you slept with your child, you were the equivalent of an axe-wielding psychopath that, you know, should be locked up, was her attitude. Now, she worked in an ER, I think, and she saw these extreme horrific cases of basically obese people who were on drugs, you know, and got really drunk and rolled over and smothered their children, which is tragic. And, of course, that doesn't happen. I mean, if you are, you know, not using drugs and not morbidly obese, you know, the odds of rolling over and smothering your child are slim. And, of course, if the woman is breastfeeding the child, and we know there's lots of benefits to, you know, psychologically, nutritionally, to, you know, feeding throughout the night, it's easier on the parents as well if the baby's right there. There's, you know, I mean, there's lots of benefits. The studies have shown there seem to be lots of benefits of co-sleeping. And I personally favor that, but there is a debate about that, and I'm not going to go in and offer like a mandate like this one size fits all. This is what's always best, but certainly I don't.
Right.
This, like I said, it's a North American debate. It isn't a debate they're having in other parts of the world because they've always co-slept.
Right, and I will tell people, look at the work of Dr. James J. McKenna. I wrote about him in a past column, and this thing about sidecar. If you're nervous, you know, you can have this little like sidecar that goes on your bed, so your baby, you won't think that you'll roll over on your baby if you're, I guess, large and drunk or something like that. In which case, maybe you shouldn't have had kids if you're drinking all the time. But that's another story. And I am forever trying to lure applied science out of academics. And we'll do a bit of that. So you write about Bobby Lowe's work looking at children's training across a number of small-scale societies. And this isn't to be workers in a factory, but you say that the values most inculcated in girls are sexual restraint and industrious, while for boys, it's self-reliance and fortitude. So talk about modern dads' influence on their kids' lives by being there.
Do you mean simply by being present with the kids or active with the
kids?
Yeah,
by being present, by being a present dad.
In terms of, you were asking about gender socialization or just in general?
Oh, no, just in general or, you know, gender-wise, because I know that there are, you know, differences for girls and boys. So, you know, answer that however you'd like.
Well, the issue of gender socialization is fascinating because, of course, you know, we view gender, as you know, there's debates about how plastic it is and how flexible it is. And at the same time, kids are clearly paying attention and modeling on their parents. But, of course, the parents are not their only influence. They, you know, their peers and their teachers have tremendous influence once they go off to school or even if they don't go to school. You know, you learn a lot from your peers and you're modeling after your peers. But the original question about male involvement and does that matter? Well, it certainly does seem to. There's debates about that. We do have some causality issues of disentangling that. Like, you know, it does seem there's a lot of evidence showing that, you know, men who are more involved with their kids do better, for example, in schools. You know, they're less likely to drop out, seem to get better grades. It's a little bit of a problem because, you know, we can't do experiments, right? We don't randomly assign men to, oh, you're going to be in this group here and you're going to have a kid and you're going to live with it, and you're going to be in this group here and have a kid and not live with it. You know, so we don't, there could be self-selection. It could be women are deciding to stay with men, you know, who are going to be better investors. And so it may not be that investing causes better outcomes. It's just that, you know, women are picking men who are both, you know, going to be have better kids and choosing to stay with those men longer. So it's a little tricky untangling that. But it does seem to be the case overall. The evidence certainly suggests that men who are more involved, and it doesn't actually seem to matter exactly what you're doing. I gave the case earlier, spending time with your kids one-on-one versus sitting on the couch. I mean, clearly, I think we can imagine one-on-one involvement can be more important. But if you've got several kids, it can be difficult to do one-on-one involvement. If you've got two or three kids in the house, they're always underfoot. It's hard to, you know, specialize and say, I'm going to spend time with just one of them, because that means spending less time with the others. And so you do something with all three. And it's hard to break that down. Research has a hard time of actually breaking that down and saying, does it matter if you spend time one-on-one versus just general time with your kids? I guess the evidence so far doesn't seem to matter. It doesn't matter that much. You just spending time with your kids or being involved with your kids, however you do it, seems to matter. Seems important. The details of, you know, it's up to almost like the individual style beyond that. You know, what is your style? Do you prefer to do A or B? That almost doesn't seem to matter that much.
So if your dad's just reading the newspaper at the table as opposed to engaging with you, that doesn't matter?
Well, I won't go for, I guess I wouldn't say that doesn't matter. I mean, certainly, you know, we see all kinds of people, you know, if you're checking your cell phone all the time, you know, when your kid's trying to talk to you, that certainly matters to talk to your kid. But if you spend hours and hours with your kid, it doesn't mean you need to be on, I think, every single minute. You know, you don't need to be solely focused on the kid. And it's important for the child to learn, too, that, you know, you're not the center of the universe. People have to do other things around you and take time off from you, and that's part of being a socialized animal living in a group living species like we do. I guess the research so far hasn't really been able to break that down. It's difficult to get long-term, large-scale studies where you're breaking down at that level, saying, you know, reading the newspaper versus watching TV versus playing a game of chess or something like that, you know, which is more important. Those are all kind of novel anyhow. If you think back, going back hundreds of thousands of years, you know, to the way we used to live, there were no newspapers. You know, you learn from your dad by you go out and hunt with him. You know, as a child, if you were male, you learned to be a hunter-gatherer by following him around, perhaps, modeling his behavior. He might not directly instruct you, you know, explicitly the way we think of going to school and you explicitly learn how to do something by a teacher telling you how to do it. They may have been a lot more casual. You may simply have learned by watching and then you'd experiment by yourself and, you know, you get it right. Sometimes you get it wrong. You kind of eventually learn. So I know you want me to give some sound science-based advice, and I have enough statistical background to realize that science for a lot of things can be a little iffy. You know, it can suggest some things, and it can suggest maybe what doesn't work. But if you want to give me specific, you should never read a newspaper around your child, I'm not going to go that far, Andy. Sorry.
No, I wasn't asking for that. And in fact, you answered with something I was going to ask you about, this modeling behaviors. And that's something that I think for a great deal of human history, you know, as far as my reading of hunter-gatherer work, Frank Marlowe, all these other people and others, you know, that there was this just, you know, children seeing what it means to be a man or a woman and what the roles are, that was very important. And so that's a part of, like, that's that passive part maybe of being a present father that you talk about, where there's passive and active and direct and indirect, that just, oh, this is what men and daddies do, that kids are taking that in without being necessarily told this is what daddies do.
That's a good point. Another thing to think about is in most societies, men have very little to do with very young children. You know, we live in a society now, especially kind of middle-class people, I think guys are expected to be involved more in changing the diapers. And certainly if you ask moms, you know, should dads be involved in changing the diapers? Is that helpful? I mean, women are going to say yes. It's certainly helpful having, you know, as somebody pointed out, I think you change, a child goes through 8,000 diapers, right? So,
oh, my God.
You know, for the over, you know, until they get, you know, housebroken, right? So, if you ask a new mom, would you appreciate having a man change 4,000 of those 8,000? Of course she's going to say yes. You know, so, but traditionally, if you look at, you know, quote-unquote pre-modern societies, men didn't do much with infants at all, but even young children, they often had very little involvement. Like those kids were hanging out almost, and in many societies, they're strongly gendered. You know, you have many societies where literally couples live apart. The women live sort of on the women's side of the village. The men live in a men's house somewhere else. Many societies are like that. Or in polygyny societies where a man may have several wives and he rotates among them, he may not spend much time at all with his young, very young children. So, you know, that is just not part of the society. Those kids are clearly growing up, turning out fine, learning how to be men, learning how to be women. They're not necessarily doing it at very young ages. At least not, they're not modeling their behavior upon their dads, except distantly. Dad may be a very distant figure. It's only when you kind of get old enough, maybe 6, 7, 8, where you can go out and be more involved, start hanging out with maybe with the men's group a little more. But men are very hands off in many societies. And our kind of modern ideas about the sort of, you know, involved father from infancy on are very new.
Well, you know, and I want to know how this affects men's health, because you write about that. You know, there are women, I get letters about this, they're stay-at-home moms, and I think there's this push that dads have to do more around the house, but these dads, they're not lazing around during the day. They're putting in a full day at work. So, you know, how does this affect dads, and is this fair, and is this smart? And maybe that's not a judgment that you are willing to make, but I thought I'd ask it anyway.
Well, it's definitely one of the things, and this is one of the things the research does show, that men are much more involved by some yardsticks in housework than they used to be, but at the same time, it's still, you know, housework and taking care of the kids, but also just doing the dishes and cooking and cleaning is still, women spend much more time on it. In any study that shows any kind of time diary usage or, you know, estimates of who's doing what, women are still doing more of that, even if they work outside the home. So, you know, the whole idea of the second shift, you know, women come home and still have a full day's work just keeping the house clean. That's true for many families. But what happens with we see in a number of studies, when couples have kids, the woman is the one who's most likely to take time off or to leave the job market for a fairly long term, stay home, take care of the kids. Men's employment activity actually increases, so men are actually working more. And you could argue, now we know there's a wage gap, and we could all argue that's not fair, but given the realities of that, it does make sense. Who should take time off? Well, it should be the person who earns less, and in our society, that happens to be women. So you could argue, well, given the realities of the pay structure, that makes sense. But clearly, when men have kids, they tend to work more in employed labor, and basically probably to make up for women working less as well. So really, the studies don't show. I mean, men might do a little more around the house than they used to, but at the same time, you're right. They are spending a lot more time in paid employment. Times have changed a lot over the past 40 years, but men still are. When people have young kids, it's women who take off, and men who don't take off. In fact, North America is, and the United States in particular, I think we rank with Australia. We are the worst in the world for paternity leave. Men simply don't take paternity leave, even if they're offered it. It's somehow viewed as detrimental to your career, to your prospects, to the perception of your coworkers. If men take off time after baby's born, there's the concern that people are going to think you're not seriously devoted to your job. Nowhere else in the world is that true. Other industrialized societies, you basically have to take time off. They give you time off. Sweden and Norway are very progressive about that and giving much more time than men have to use. Or they can transfer to the partner, I think, under some of these countries. But the United States, we simply don't take time off after kids are born. Guys don't. Women do, but guys don't, even if they're offered that. Of course, many jobs, you're not even offered that. There's paid leave or unpaid leave. You can legally take it for a woman. Men often can't even do that. But even if they have the option, they simply don't.
And I want to move on to a very interesting issue you talk about, which is stepfathers. Now, it does not make evolutionary sense for a man to invest in kids who are not genetically theirs. However, you say that stepfathers sometimes invest in a woman's children, and you think it may be a form of mating effort, so as a way to please the woman.
Yes. I mean, the argument, it doesn't make evolutionary sense. That's if you look strictly, am I propagating my genes? By investing in this child and in another man's child, in a sense, it's very clear that that wouldn't make sense, right? This is another man's child. He's getting a free load, basically. He's getting a free ride. I'm going to raise his kid for him. He's not investing as much in the kid. But, and this actually comes from the primate and the bird literature, where you see a number of cases where males would step in, and the idea being by helping to invest in this child, you might increase your odds of having a subsequent child with this woman, or in the case of other species, with this female. So, in that sense, it makes sense because it's basically a mating effort. You're helping this woman to help raise her kid, and that makes you a more attractive mate. So the idea being, you think from a woman's perspective, if you're a single mom with a kid, would you rather have a male who might help you raise your kid or a male who didn't? I mean, you're obviously gonna and a male who's potentially aggressive or homicidal. I mean, this is sort of a counter reaction. I mean, the work that Daly and Wilson did, which was excellent work on the risks associated with stepfathers, was great work. Some people came away with the impression that stepfathers are homicidal almost because they're more likely to abuse children. They're associated with homicide and so forth. And that's true, but it's a relative risk issue. I mean, you're much more likely to die if you're a child with a stepfather than living with a bio dad. But still, the rates are very low. Most men who are stepfathers are investing, as it turns out, quite a bit in their kids, given that it's not their kids. And it begs explanation. Why are they spending time and money on kids who aren't theirs? Well, the logic is this is a way of maintaining the relationship, investing in the relationship with the woman, and possibly getting more offspring out of that. And in fact, that's what I found in some of the work I've done on this, where, stepdads don't get as many extra children from this as men who never have stepkids, but they get a lot more than basically men who simply never marry at all. So if that's the price you have to pay to gain access to a spouse, to a long-term relationship that might get you offspring, it does seem worth it.
Yeah, and just to explain, that's the research by the late Margot Wilson and by Martin Daly about the darker side of step-parents, as you put it, that a stepdad is more likely to do some horrible thing to the child. But as you point out, these are very, very low numbers, and people need to remember that. So we don't have too much time left. I want to move on to gay parents. So if there are two gay men, or as the story goes, if Heather has two mommies, it's just that's a very new thing. Humans, for the most of human history, lived in bands and nuclear families, and so even if they had gay parents, they would have had a lot of men and women modeling behavior around. So is it important for gay parents to have some regular uncle or auntie who's very much in the kids' lives, whatever the opposite sex person would be who's not there?
That's a very good question. I don't know much research on it. I'll have to say I don't know any research. I do know of some recent studies that have looked at same-sex parents and found there doesn't seem to be any detrimental effect on the kids at all in terms of their psychological well-being and their schooling outcomes and whatnot. So, you know, a lot of the concerns people had that, yeah, growing up with two parents, you know, the kid would somehow grow up maladjusted or whatever, don't seem to be playing out. And part of the thing is, of course, unless you live on an island just by, you know, these two parents and their kid, you know, yeah, you're not the only people involved. There might be literally uncles, or there might be friends of the families who are involved, but there's also going to be teachers. There's going to be other people in their lives. Again, the parents are important, but they are hardly my wife is a sociologist. She's quick to point out, you know, there's always those social forces, including peers, who are really strong influences on children, and there are school teachers, all those kind of things. So we live in most of us live in cities of tens, hundreds of thousands of people. You know, you're not just, your parents are not the only thing in your life. So if you live maybe in a community that was all women or all men, I don't know, maybe it would have some, you can imagine, maybe, I don't know, some effect. But we, you know, that you can't even, you can't even do a study to look at that because that just doesn't exist. We live in mixed-sex societies. So even if you grow up with two parents of the same gender, there's plenty of people of the opposite gender around to model your behavior on. You've got friends, you know, certainly who have almost certainly heterosexual parents, you know, couples that you can look at what the other person does that might not be in your household. So that doesn't seem to be that big of an issue.
Yeah, I do agree. We have a media-heavy society, but I think, you know, direct contact is also important. And by the way, just for anybody who's interested, that research, it's by some really good research on gay parents and how well they do and how well their kids do. It's by Judith Stacy and Tim Bednarz with a Z. I know that research pretty well. So we're almost out of time. I would love to have you give us some final words of advice for men looking to be great dads.
Men looking to be great dads. You know, I should have written maybe, if I knew this, I would write a self-help book, perhaps. Looking to be a great dad, trust yourself, I guess. Go with your instincts, and we have millions of years of instincts kind of guiding you of what's, you know, there's so many help. The thing is, if you look on the shelf at the self-help books, right, whatever you want to do, you'll find a book that tells you that's okay, and you'll find five books saying don't do that, probably. So, I mean, the advice I find kind of limited. I definitely found that when I started doing research, when I was expecting to have kids, that you can do anything, you know, almost, because somebody out there thinks it's right and somebody thinks it's wrong. You have to trust yourself. I would recommend, as a caveat, you know, there was a recent article about dad bods, the whole, you know, actually really following people about weight gain. And, you know, most of the guys I've talked to, and myself included, it's very easy to put on the pounds after you have kids because you don't have time to take care of yourself and to exercise and to eat right. So I'd recommend not waiting, you know, till you know, 20 years go by and you gain 50 pounds, you know, try to put the brakes on it earlier, but that can be more difficult. So that's more of a question about men's health rather than being a great dad. But they go hand in hand, because being a great dad can be meaning being involved with your kids and staying healthy.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're saying basically is to do what my dad did, which is to spend time with your kids. And my dad he didn't sit there and talk to us about life like Aristotle's advice or anything like that. He just hung out with us on Saturdays, and he was there, and he, you know, brought home the bacon, as they say, although we didn't get bacon because we were Jews. Bad. I've made up for that in later life. But so, you know, just to have a dad around, you know, because then dads will do dad things, you know, screw in the, you know, picture frame or whatever, and you'll see those things. He'll fix the car. I think that that's more important than we realize.
I definitely think so. And I mean, we have a growing society where, of course, about a third of couples are unmarried at the time that the child's born, and for about half of those, they don't live together. So about half are living together, half are not. You don't have to necessarily live with your kids full time, you know, to be a great dad. You know, you see them when you can. You're not just a wallet, and you're not just a sperm donor. We certainly, you know, we haven't even touched on the issue of what is fatherhood. Of course, we live in a society now where you can have sperm donors who are not who are the biological father but not the social father. Clearly, fatherhood is more than just about donating sperm. It's more than just about being a wallet or providing, you know, a paycheck or a child support payment. It's, you know, caring for the kid, being involved in the kid. You can do that and not be related to the kid at all. You can be a social father, a stepfather, or an adoptive father and be a wonderful father and not necessarily have any genes with that child. But really, I think, yeah, being involved with the kid, those are what's going to forge the memories. You're remembering you know, your time with your dad years later. And that's the kind of stuff you remember.
Yeah, exactly. So this has been Amy Alcon's Human Lab, The Science Between Us. My guest tonight has been anthropologist Kermit Anderson. His book is Fatherhood, Evolution, and Human Paternal Behavior, and his blog at Psychology Today is The Evolving Father. Thank you so much. This is a very interesting show.
Thank you.